Where'd he go?
Where'd he go? On your left.
Oh, okay. Good evening. On behalf of Rabbi Wolf, it's my pleasure to welcome you to this special series on the three temples. We have a very distinguished, noted historian and dean of Eula Girls' School, Rabbi Abraham Lieberman. It's a very timely presentation in the 3 weeks. First, I'd like to thank the sponsors of this evening, Mati and Chaya Mechal Sladowitz, and Nachi and Hedy Silverman. Also like to thank Chaki for the beautiful poster. Just, you know, all of his posters are beautiful, but this one just was magnificent. I just want to mention that Rav Yaakov Emden, over 100 years ago in his Siddur, wrote that all tzaras in Klal Yisrael is because we don't cry for the Beis HaMikdash. Wrote this a very long time ago. And I think we don't have the real appreciation for what we're missing. And I think with this series of lectures, we should get a better feel of this. Without further ado, Rabbi Lieberman.
By the way, if you need any more handouts, we have plenty. Do you have to pass them out here? I have this amazing responsibility for the next hour to take you on a journey. And if I succeed this week and next week, then with Hashem's help, we will not meet for the third week. And we'll be zoche to see the Binyan Bayis Shlishi with our own eyes. Slight correction, Rabbi Yaakov Emden wrote that more than 250 years ago. And so did, and we'll see a little bit of the same idea. I think this period of time is so perfect for learning what I would love to learn tonight with your help. And also, I encourage you, if there is something which makes no sense, I use a word you've never heard before. If I create a word I've never heard before, please stop me and say, hey, what does that mean? When the hour or so is over, I want you to be so inspired that you will run out and buy materials to be ready for this awesome building, which I would love to take you back to. I have the privilege of being about 4,000 years old, and I do remember the glorious days of when we say Hashiveinu Hashem Elecha v'noshuvo chadesh yomeinu, as it used to be, because I'm a Kohen, and I tell you, if tomorrow someone says we've built it, I will be the first in line to do the avoda. I'm ready. But what is this all about? So before we get to the handout that's in front of you, I need to make a number of points very clear. There's one piece of real estate in the world called Har HaBayis. And that piece of real estate is rather small. Its importance is enormous. It is priceless. And let me explain it to you a little bit in the context of Jewish philosophy. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, in his wonderful monumental work called the Kuzari, where he has a discussion going between a Jewish sage, if you remember, and a Christian sage, and a philosopher, and a Muslim sage, arguing about the true religion, which in the end, Baruch Hashem, is the religion that we've lived with and has stayed with us, and at the end of the day, we're the only people on the face of this earth with the memory of that reality to this day, 5,000 years of history behind us. So based on Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, let me develop the following point. If someone would ask a Muslim, what do you think of the holiest place for the Christian world? Which to this, at least for Catholics, it's St. Peter's Basilica somewhere. The Muslim would say, I couldn't care less about it. Flip it around, ask any Christian about the holiest place of Islam, of Mecca, and they'll tell you, I couldn't care less about it. Ask anybody in the world about Yerushalayim, and everybody wants it. And the reason clearly is because Yerushalayim to everyone, at the end of the day, represents what we call the MS or the truth. Yerushalayim stands for what everyone at the end of the day knows is the ultimate. And somewhere in Yerushalayim, and just notice for a minute, and we'll get to this a little bit next week, but do you know how many names Yerushalayim has? Anybody guess? Yerushalayim has how many names that you can think of? Think of your learning of Nevi'im. It's called Tzion, Ir David, Hamokom, Shalem. Okay. At the end of the day, Chazal tell us, Shivim, Shemos, Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim has 70 names. When a place is that beloved to a people that we are able to give it 70 names, then you begin to understand how important it is. Keep that in mind. In addition, listen as I read with you a particular Mishnah that's not in your handout that begins with the following. It's called, it's in Maseches Kelim, it's Perek Aleph at the end, it's the last few Mishnayos. And it reads like this. It says, Eser Kedushos Hein. There are 10 levels of holiness. Now, you'd assume the world that Hashem created would inherently have holiness all around. Here in L.A., this is holy ground because Hashem created it. But at the end of the day, that is not so. There is only one place in the world where Kedusha, holiness, is, and that's in the land of Israel. So the Mishnah says, in the land of Israel, there are 10 levels of holiness. And the first level, says the Mishnah, Eretz Yisrael Mekudeshes Mikol Ha'aretz. The land of Israel itself, in its entirety, from top to bottom, has holiness. And then the Mishnah says, and what is its holiness? What makes Israel holy? So the Mishnah answers, Shemevim Mimenu HaOmer HaBikurim Ushtei HaLechem. Because in the land of Israel will fulfill these three mitzvos, the bringing of the Omer, the Bikurim, the first fruits, and that famous Shtei HaLechem that is brought on Shavuos, which you can't bring from anywhere else in the world. The Omer must be cut in the land of Israel. The first fruits must be the fruits of the land of Eretz Israel. And then it tells us the next level, moving up. Ayaros Hamukofos Chomo, the cities that had a wall around it from the days of Yeshua ben Nun, those are Mekudoshos Mimeno. Those are even a higher level because we send out from those cities, we don't allow into the cities that have a wall from the days of Yeshua ben Nun anyone that had tzaras or had leprosy. And the burial ceremonies in that city had to be conducted slightly differently. And then it says, moving on to the next level. And the words are, Lifnim min hachoma. Once you pass the wall of Yerushalayim, you have now entered a higher level of Kedusha. So in the land of Israel, the minute you step in, you've reached level one. You walk into a city that has a wall from antiquity, you are now on a higher level. Walk into Yerushalayim, you've now reached another high level. And from there, you move on to Har HaBayis. And now I have to stop for a second. Does everyone know what I mean when I say Har HaBayis? If you do not, please raise your hand, because we all know what Har HaBayis is. Sorry? Okay, Har HaBayis, yes? Don't be embarrassed to say no. We all know what it is? Okay. Oh, explain it. Thank you. Okay, let me try the next question, and please participate. How many of us in this room had the privilege to daven, pray, bimispalo at the Kotel, the Kosel, the wall? Who has not been there? Okay, so when you face the wall on top of you, where today there's that huge compound of mosques and whatever else is up there, that entire area we today call Har HaBayis. So the minute you enter that area, because at some point, you'll see soon, we build the first Beis HaMikdash there, that area is called Har HaBayis, the mountain of the house. This referring, of course, to the house of Hashem. The minute you enter Har HaBayis, you must be in a state of pure, complete purity. That's why archaeology has found, and maybe we'll not discuss it this week, but next week, at least that part, all around the area of entrances to Har HaBayis, mikvos. Because as people came to Har HaBayis, if they were tameh, they were impure, they would run to the mikvah, dry up, leave all their belongings in lockers, wooden lockers all around, and some actually made out of stone, leave their wallets and everything there, take off their shoes, no money, and went up onto Har HaBayis. So that level itself made it even holier than that. And then there was a point where non-Jews could no longer enter. And what is interesting is the Mishnah tells us here that from that point and on, She'ein HaGoyim Nichnasim L'Sham, from there and on, non-Jews were not allowed. And archaeology has uncovered about 50 years ago one sign, and today we found two more, which were at different entrances, written in three languages, telling whoever it is that came to visit Yerushalayim, if you are a non-Jew, please do not proceed past this point, because that, again, was a higher level of Kedusha. And at that point, if you follow me all along, you actually came into the women's section of the Beis HaMikdash, which we will not speak of this week, because it is enlarged and it becomes an Ezras Nashim only in Bayis Sheni, in Bayis Rishon, it was a very tiny area, and that again was a higher level. And from there and on, you come to the place what we call the Azara, and then where the Kohanim are, and eventually you come to the holiest of places known as the Kodesh HaKadosh. So as you are in that area, you immediately begin to sense that you are in presence of holiness, and you have to know that with every step that you take, you are now literally in a very different world. For next week too, there are particular halachas for Yerushalayim. For example, no house in Yerushalayim was allowed to be built with a balcony. No balconies anywhere in Yerushalayim. If you had balconies in your own private yard, that was okay. But into the open streets of Yerushalayim, you could not have even sometimes nails protruding out of the wall. Because if something tameh was under it, and a kohen walked under there, he would become tameh himself and not be able to. There were no garbage cans in Yerushalayim. Not on the streets, maybe privately in your own backyard again, but the garbage in the street was never allowed because it would bring about things which can make things impure. That is the city of Yerushalayim. Having said all that as a background, do me a favor and turn to your handout. On the front cover, you'll notice there is a picture or a depiction that says Solomon's Temple. Solomon's Temple didn't look anything like that, but it's a good picture. People were fascinated by the Beis HaMikdash, and everyone sat down, read Sefer Melachim and Divrei HaYomim and try to get some sense of what it looked like, and created a tremendous amount of literature. In fact, if you're into art, we could have a lecture one day about all the pictures of Bais Rishon or Solomon's Temple. None of them correct, but pretty interesting depictions because people try to imagine what they've never seen, and you'll see a little bit more of that. On top, there's a very famous pasuk from Yeshaya here, which basically says that on your walls, Yerushalayim, hifkadati shomrim kol hayom v'chol alayla. I set watchmen or people to watch Yerushalayim all day and all night. I am sure you are aware of the fact that this custom of never ever leaving Yerushalayim or the walls of Yerushalayim alone 24/7 is still in use today. There are people who will sit and learn or make 24-hour shifts continuously, including Shabbos. So there's never a moment when someone is not present, usually in the area of where the kotel is or the kotel, sitting, learning, davening. There's always someone there. In fact, if you are in Yerushalayim and you want to sign up to do part of the Shmira of Yerushalayim, you are more than welcome to do that. And then on the left side at the bottom is at least the cover of one of hundreds of svarim written through the ages by different chachamim. This is a very famous one. This is the Turas Beis HaMikdash of the Tosfos Yom Tov, who wrote a commentary to the Mishnah, who actually, if you see the small print there, is pretty sure that he is writing this book with the intention of any day now we will build Bayis Shlishi and we need to know what it looks like. And he has his ideas based on the Nevuos of Yecheskel, which you'll hear a little bit mentioned today and much more in the third lecture if we get punished and we don't get to build the temple, and you'll have to come back for that lecture. Then we'll speak of the Nevuah of Yecheskel, who describes Bayis Shlishi. Having said all that, let's learn something. So please turn to page 1 and notice every source is numbered. And again, please, if you have any questions, any comment, feel free to ask. I promise you there is no test at the end of the lecture. It's the teacher in me that always worries that someone's nervous about a test, so I want to tell you there are no quizzes, there are no tests, because everything you will learn tonight you'll take to heart and walk out of here ready to build the bias. So look at source number 1, just to put things in perspective as far as halacha. Says the Rambam, mitzvas asei, there's a positive commandment. Lasos bayis lashem muchon lios makrivim bo hakarbonos. There's a mitzvah from the Torah to make a house for Hashem, which would always be ready to bring sacrifices there. And of course, he says, because it becomes our religious duty, v'chogin olav shalosh pamim b'shana, and we are required to go and celebrate there as holidays 3 times a year. Shenemar, and here are the words, v'osu l'mikdosh v'shulchanti b'socham. Hashem says to us, make for me a Beis HaMikdosh so I can allow my spirit to rest there. My Shechina, or whatever that in its deeper meaning means. This is a mitzvah saseh, by the way, b'chol hadoros, even today, and every single second that we're not building the Beis HaMikdosh, we have to have a good excuse why we're not doing that. Of course, we have. But literally speaking, this is a mitzvah asei. And now that we are living in the land of Israel, we should build it. We can't for a whole bunch of other reasons. Maybe, God forbid, it would put one's life in danger. And according to most poskim, this is not the mitzvah that you need to put your life in danger for. Some do say you have to, but that's a whole different discussion. Not for now. If you want me to come back one day and tell you why we should put our lives in danger to build Bayis Shlishi, of course, they might take me away if I, you know, somehow expound that kind of an idea, but some people do think so, especially now that we have sovereignty in this land. And here's the dichotomy of the paradox, those words that no one knows what they mean, to show you that at the end of the day, we are still in Golos. is the holiest of all places, the place that literally belongs to us from the beginning of time. That's where Adam HaRishon was created from according to one source. That's the place where the Luchos were cut out from the Eben HaShisia, which is there. That's where the Akedah took place. That's where Yaakov slept. That's Har HaMoriah. The holiest of our places is not in our hands. Yes, it is, but it isn't. Try to figure that one out. That's the difficulty here. Just ask these people to, okay, you know what? Build a mosque over there. This is our place, and let's make peace and be nice to each other. But of course, we know that it needs a higher force to make something like that happen. So keep that in mind. Then, of course, the Rambam goes on and speaks about the Mishkan for a minute, which was a temporary building for Hashem. Then comes Halacha Beis, and let's just go through it for historical purposes. Says the Rambam, Kivon Shenichnasu La'aretz, the minute they came into the land, Hamidu HaMishkan, they put the Mishkan in this place called Gilgal, and it was there for 14 years. And then they came to Shiloh, and there they built a bias too, and they put nice curtains there. It didn't have a roof, says the Rambam. And then he adds, Vishin Samach Teshona Omar HaMishkan Shiloh. Mishkan Shiloh, which was a mini Beis HaMikdash, if you want, stood for 369 years. That's a long time. At least this is the Rambam's accounting of all these years. And of course, Ukushemes Eli, then it gets destroyed, they bring it to Nov, and then when Shmuel dies, that gets destroyed, it comes to Givon, and eventually from Givon, we come to Yerushalayim. That means this particular temporary residence of the Shekhinah moves from place to place, and eventually the Beis HaMikdash itself is built. Therefore comes Halacha Gimel, Kivon Shenivna HaMikdash B'Yerushalayim Nesu Kol HaMakomos. Once we build it, from here and on, you cannot bring sacrifices anywhere else, and this is the ultimate place. And he describes, this is Har HaMoriah. And then Halacha Dalah, just for information that we'll need in the next 2 weeks. Binyan Shebono Shlomo, Kfar Meforosh B'Malachim, the building that Shlomo HaMelech built is described. Its plan is in Sefer Malachim. It's a little more intricate than that, but we'll discuss that eventually. V'chen binyan ha'osi lihibonos, and also the building that we are awaiting to build. Afal pi shehu kosev v'yicheskel, even though it's written in Yicheskel, and we'll discuss much of this in the third lecture with Hashem's help, eino mefarosh, it's not that clear. And anshe bayis sheni, which we'll speak of next week, k'shebonu b'mei Ezra, but when they built the second temple, they built it, says he, like the building of Shlomo, and a little bit like the building that Yecheskel describes, because their descriptions are slightly different. Okay, so you have this information. Any questions? No questions. Okay, let's move on. Yes? I'm sorry? Yes. It was the Mishkan at Shiloh. Yes, it's a Mishkan, yeah. Temporary dwelling with curtains over it, that's it. Yes.
At what point was it become halakhically unacceptable to bring Korban?
Anywhere, the minute Bayis Rishon was built.
So in Shiloh, people were still bringing
yes.
their own Korban. Okay. So that only happened in Solomon's temple.
Okay, they were not supposed to do that, but they did. Yeah. Okay. Any other questions, comments? Do you begin to sense yet how much we're missing? Or like, a long time ago, Rabbi, that building has nothing to do with me. Okay, so let's move on. Look at source number two. And I think source number two should make every one of you in this room feel that what you have accomplished tonight, just by being here, even if you're not listening, is absolutely unbelievable. Says Medrash Tanchuma, on the first line there, it's in Parshas Tzav, where it says, Chen Omar Rabbi Shmuel Bar Abba, Omar HaKadosh Baruch Hu Yisrael, said Hashem to the Jewish people, Af al pi, shebeis hamikdash osuli chorev, even though the Beis HaMikdash will be destroyed, v'hakarbonos betelin, and sacrifices will be done away with, lo tishkochu atzmachem l'sader hakarbonos. Don't forget about learning about the karbonos. Elo huzur likros bohem l'shanos bohem. And then it says, V'im ta'asku bohem ani male aleichem ki ilu b'karbonos atem oskim. So even though this bias will get destroyed, don't forget the karbonos. Learn about them. Speak about them. And then look at the next line. V'imrin tzom choleda, how important this is, it says, come and see, k'she HaKadosh Baruch Hu mara l'yecheskel. This Yecheskel that we keep on bringing up, who in the last chapters of Yecheskel, from Perek Mem and on, describes Bayis Shlishi. So when Hashem showed him as Tzuras HaBayis, this particular new building, Mahu Omer, Hincha Haged es Beis Yisrael es HaBayis v'chalmu me'avonoseichem u'moridu es HaTavnis. So Yecheskel is told, show the Jewish people the plans for the third temple. And this is what it will look like. And they'll build it, and their particular sins will stop. Now let me remind you that the Navi Yecheskel went into Golos many years before the destruction of the Bayis, close to 20 years. He is already in Bavel. The Beis HaMikdash Bayis Rishon is still standing. He's being told that it will be destroyed. And eventually, while he is in Bavel, he hears about his destruction. At the same time, he has a prophecy about the third one with a plan for it. And at that point, it says, Omar Yecheskel lefnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu, says Yecheskel to Hashem, Rabbona Shel Olam, Ad Achshav Onu Nesunim Begola. Where are we living right now? We're in America. We're in Bavel. We're in Los Angeles. Be'eretz Oneinu, in the land of our enemies. Va'ata Omer Li, and you tell me, Leilach, to go lehodia le'Israel, and to let the Jewish people know, Tzuras HaBayis, a particular plan for a building, and I should tell them about it. Ve'ishmur es kol ha'tzuros, and they should keep all these things, and all these other things. How could they do all the mitzvos and everything? God, they're too busy. They're not in their own land, says Yecheskel. Leave them alone, Atshe Yalu Min HaGola, until they'll come home. Don't tell them about the Beis HaMikdash now in Golos. Tell them about the Beis HaMikdash when they're home, when they're in their homeland. V'achakach, and when they're home, says the Novi Ani Holech, I'll go and tell them what the plans are for building it. Omalei HaKadosh Baruch Hu Yecheskel, said Hashem to Yecheskel, Bishvil Shebonai Nesunim B'Gola, Yehi Binyan Beisi Batel. Because you're in Golos, my house shouldn't be built. What kind of an excuse is that? Omalei HaKadosh Baruch Hu Godol Kriyosor B'Torah. If you read about the Beis HaMikdash in the Torah, if you study the sources about what it is all about, therefore, keep on reading, V'Sasku Likros Tzuras HaBayis B'Torah, B'schar kriyoso, she'isasku likros bo. If you just read about the Beis HaMikdash, if you just learn about it, says Hashem, ani male aleichem ki'ilu hem oskim bebidyan habayis. Just by showing up here tonight, by coming to listen a little bit about the actual descriptions of what was and what we hope will be, learning its measurements, studying every single inch of what this building looked like, and being experts in the building, well, he said, what do I care? Let someone build it and stare. At the end of the day, part of the mitzvah of Asli Mikdash is that every Jew should know every single detail of Hashem's house. You're concerned about your house, every room in your house? Kal v'chomer ben benoshel kal v'chomer, that we should worry about Hashem's house and what that looks like and what we can do to actually bring about its building. A similar point is made in source number 3. Rabbeinu Bachaye, or Bachya, actually his name is Bachayai, but okay, says, Da, you should know, ki sipur b'inyan ha-mishkan v'kelav, that the story about the Mishkan and all its utensils, and the chakira and the tchuna and the tsurosov u'movosov, and the shiur of its length and its width and its height, af al pish ein beis ha-migdosh kayom mitzvah gedolahi. To study about the Beis HaMikdash, even though there isn't one, is a huge, enormous mitzvah. At shomayim yagi asachara. The reward for studying this reaches all the way up to heaven. V'torahi, and this is Torah. And therefore, l'lamed on the tzrichi, we have to learn it. Similar to what we said earlier, knowing every detail about karbonos, even though we don't have karbonos. And that's, by the way, why many people are very makbid to say karbanos, both at shachris and at mincha, because that's part of this idea of reminding ourselves exactly of what we're missing. If we don't talk about the karbanos, we don't know what they're about, and therefore we begin to learn it. So begin to realize how important all these things are. If you look at the source number 4, the Shloha HaKadosh, quoting from an earlier Sefer Kabbalah, called Shari Ora from Rabbi Yosef Ibn Jigatila, who explains, and I'll put it in short, the travelings of the Shekhinah. Adam HaRishon was created in a way where the Shekhinah was literally there, but because he sins, the Shekhinah gets removed. And something needs to be done to bring it back in some way or form. Eventually the Mishkan brings it back, but it brings it back in a very different way, not totally. And of course, we build the Beis HaMikdash again. And what do we do then? We sin and we lose the Shekhinah again. And therefore, the point would be to reach the stage of Va'asali Mikdash V'Shochanti V'Socham, bring the Shekhinah back, literally almost in our face, where because of the level that we've reached and we've built a bias for Hashem, Hashem is able to take his glory and have it dwell amongst us in some way where we can understand it. And then if you look at source number 5, the Baal HaTanya also, when he speaks about the Mikdash, makes a distinction between bias Rishon and bias Sheni. And there was a huge difference between the two, because the Shekhinah was mitzumtzemet itself through tzimtzum and allowed its glory to be somehow felt and understood. And now we don't have it. And something has to be done to bring it back. And by Sheni, as you see, the underlined words, maybe they're not underlined, but there's like 3 dots there. But by Sheni, Shelohoyu ba'aron v'haluchos, Omru Chazal, Shelohoysa ba'Shekhinah. Shoysa shara ba'is rishon, Sheloh kederach ishtashalus ha'olamos. But in Bayis Sheni, it's already in a different form. And now even that is not there. And then skipping to source number 6, all of us have learned at some point that very famous Chazal that says, Kol dor she'ein nivne b'yomav, any generation that does not merit the building of the Beis HaMikdash in its days, ki'ilu nechrap b'yomav. It's as if almost we have caused its destruction. Imagine the awesomeness of that statement. So the Sfas Emes asks, Kasha, how could this be? Shehare Shehoyu Harbe Doros Tzadike Elyon. There are many great tzadikim. Shehoyu Royal Leos Nechrav B'Yemehem. So how could it be? So he says something quite astounding. Says the Sfas Emes, you should know, Benir Elefarish on the 3rd line, the last 5 words. Source number 6. Ki kol yemeha doros mitstarfin Umiskansin kol ha'oro shel avodas b'nei Yisrael yosroyon l'geula. Every single generation adds to the building of the bias. And if we don't add to it, literally, we have caused this destruction. Skip a line, Rakshis Chus kol dor v'dor, every single generation, ozer umevi ma'at binyan beis ha'migdosh, v'ha'binyan nimshach kol yimei ha'golos. And only when every single one of us, having lived a life of doing mitzvos and having the focus of having the Shekhinah return, begins to add to this huge project of building Bayis Shlishi. hopefully through learning about this a little bit, keeping all that in mind, we can come to the building of the bias. Okay. Now you're so inspired, you want to pick up a shovel and come and dig. So now let's relax a little bit. Question. Since all of you, almost all of you, have had the privilege of davening at the Kotel, at the Wall, the Western Wall, the Whiteling Wall, just to make sure I cover everyone's understanding of it, have you also had the privilege to, for about 24 shekel, to walk into something called Bayit Saruf? Is there anyone who knows what Bayit Saruf is? Raise your hand. Whoa, okay, we got five people maybe. If you haven't seen Bayit Saruf, I strongly suggest next time you are in Yerushalayim, you should go see Bayit Saruf. And I use that only as an example to explain to you something about archaeology. Archaeology works in an amazing way, especially in Eretz Yisrael. Because imagine the following. For those of you who don't know, Bayit Saruf was discovered in 1967, right after the Six-Day War, when archaeologists had a field day. They wanted to dig the entire old city of Yerushalayim, but the government said, no, we're giving you 6 months to dig. Dig whatever you want. But after 6 months, we're closing it up, and people need to live here and build their homes, and we're not turning Yerushalayim, the old city, into an archaeological park or museum. And archaeology began to dig. And they discovered this home called the House of Katros. Katros was a Kohen, whose name we know from the Mishnah, Emsachim. And this Kohen Katros lived in this house with his family, eating dinner. During the siege of Yerushalayim by the Romans, by the time of the destruction of Bais Sheni, if you remember the Beis Hamikdash itself, is Nechrav on the 9th and the 10th of Av, but the upper city of Yerushalayim, Romans broke through at the end of the month of Elul, like on the 26th day of Elul. On the 26th day of Elul, the Romans come to the upper city and devastate the entire area and kill whoever's there. Katros's house, with everyone in it, with his entire family, just gets, so to say, covered over and die in that house. Part of the building begins to burn, at least the part of the wooden structure of this house, and it stays like that from the time of the Churban in the year 70 CE until 1967, when Nachman Avigad, who was one of the great diggers of Yerushalayim, and he dug with a great sense of holiness because he understood where he was digging, discovers a room and bones and a table and the dishes and the leftovers that have stayed here for about 2,000 years. In fact, the archaeologists who dug it up testify to the smell of the burn of the wood that burned at the time of the destruction of Bais Sheni. Yes? That's the burnt house. Okay, I should have said the burnt house. 2 points for you. Okay, now we have 10 more people who've seen the burnt house. Okay, Bayit Saruf translates into the burnt house. Sorry. Good point. But why am I bringing this up? One, because archaeology has allowed us a tiny glimpse into Bayit Rishon. It also has allowed us to understand how all this works. Because to go today, in the year 2000, whatever it is, 2013, if you want to enter the burnt house, okay, if you've been to Yerushalayim, this is next to like Bunker's Bagels or some bagel store right up there. It's like when you come from the Kotel, you walk up the steps in the Jewish part of the old city. There's like a little pizza store. You take two more steps up, and right there is the burnt house. And then there's like a bookstore there. And if you keep on going, you come into the main square that all of us know. But in order to get to the burnt house, I walked down over 200 steps. And that was in the days of Bais Sheni, the upper city of Yerushalayim. I'm standing up here. I walked 200 steps to get to the burnt house, which was the higher part of Yerushalayim earlier. Because archaeology in Israel works very simply. Whoever came and conquered Jerusalem, covered up and built on top. Next person came, conquered, destroyed, burned, leveled it, built on top. Next one came, built on top. Recently, Dan Bahat, one of the great archaeologists of Yerushalayim today, who knows every inch of Yerushalayim, recently means like 4 years ago, uncovered a room. Imagine this room. Okay, it's about half the size of this room, standing from what we call the Muslim period and go straight down, room after room after room, into the time period of Bais Rishon. One room. We just keep on going lower and lower and lower, and they've uncovered that. If you've been at the Kotel recently, in back of you, if you face the wall, you'll see that whole enclosure where they are now digging. It's up there already for 2 or maybe 2.5 years that they're digging there. And if you have nothing to do there, open the door and walk in. They'll let you. Just when they're not looking, go in, walk the other way. Or, if you don't want to do that, then go up to the streets of the old city and watch from up there what they found down there. And we now know today that the walls of the city of Yerushalayim, the days of Shlomo HaMelech, were much larger than we think they were. And stuff was uncovered there, which is absolutely unbelievable. So the evidence for all of our history, at least in Yerushalayim, has been saved. It's there. It's been dug up. Sadly, though, of course, our holiest of places, we can't go digging, and maybe we don't want to go digging there. But if you remember, if you've read your newspapers in the last couple of years, Muslims have built a third mosque up there, and they have dug up a tremendous amount of earth and basically dumped it. So let me show you where they dumped it for a minute, since you have your handout. Skip for a minute over page number 2. And go to what we call page number 3, just to give you an idea. Notice smack in the middle of the page, there's something called the Tyropoean Valley. It's also known as the Valley of the Cheesemakers, because cheesemakers lived in this valley. This is literally the valley of where Yerushalayim was at its bottom. Then totally on the other side, notice towards the bottom, the Kidron Valley, and of course you know where Har HaZeisim is, right there, the Mount of Olives. What has happened in the last couple of years, thousands of tons of earth with very important archaeological artifacts have been taken right off Har HaBayis by the truckful, with no one saying a word, and all of it dumped right at the bottom of what we call the Mount of Olives and in the Ophel Hill of the Kidron Valley. Until quite recently, if you've gone to Israel, that's one of the places where people go. You tell the taxi driver, take me to the place where people are just sifting through sand and finding stuff. Thank God, recently the state of Israel tried to control it a drop more to see what was found in there and what is in there and try to find some of the rest of this earth, because at the end of the day, this is Admas Kodesh. It comes from Har HaBayis. And it's been dumped all around. And again, that's part of the pain of the Golus, that we can't control that. And only Mashiach Tzidkenu, hopefully, will help, because otherwise, who knows what will be. So now if you go back to page 2, to very quickly give you an idea. So all the way to the left on the upper page, what's numbered as picture number 1, notice pretty much what Eretz Israel looked like in the days of Bais Rishon or around David HaMelech's time. There you have Yerushalayim. The Plishtim or the Philistines, pretty much where they are. And then notice the kingdoms of Aram, the nations of Ammon, Moab, and Edom, which were quiet around in those days. And then go to picture number 2, and we'll see a little bit of this today. Notice, and in most of these pictures, to give us a sense of reality, archaeologists or cartographers always put a present-day walls of the old city in it, imposed on it to give you an idea of how it is. So notice what we call the walls of Yerushalayim today. If I say to you, where is the Kotel? Can you pinpoint it on that map? Where would it be? The answer is it would be on the side right here. Here where it says altar, you turn it this way, and this is the wall of the Kotel today. But in the days of David HaMelech and Shlomo HaMelech, what becomes known as the city of Yerushalayim was not settled yet. And most people lived in what is known as the city of David, or Ir David, which was in the south. So if you've been to Yerushalayim recently, when you look in what we call the Silwan, anybody not know what I'm talking about? When you take the number one or the number two bus into Shar HaAshbot, if you look down, which is totally Arab villages today, some Jews live there too, that is the area of Ir David. That's where David HaMelech lived, and I'll come back to that in a minute. Now, Shlomo, if you look again, just to give you an idea of four, the city gets a little bit larger and more, I guess, built, solidified, fortified. And then, of course, for the next picture, just for a second, to give an idea of the Assyrian Empire, which begins to really take away and eat away at the empire of the Jewish people, which we'll discuss more in a minute. Notice that Eretz Israel gets split into two, and that's the point when the 10 tribes are taken away, and half of Eretz Israel so becomes part of the Assyrian Empire. But now let's discuss the Beis HaMikdash for a minute. And now I need you to pay attention to detail. Look at picture number 7, and look at picture number 8. And I should tell you, in picture number 8, since all of you are great architects, the Beis HaMikdash is all the way on top, the highest mountain, that's where it should be. On the upper left is Ir David, and you'd walk up from Ir David, literally, and notice how the houses are set up in Ir David. It's from the lowest to the next, to the next, to the next, to the next, to the next. Makes you understand very easily in the story of David HaMelech and Bathsheba that David is looking on the roof and he sees someone else's roof. And Bathsheba, if you remember, was taking a bath. He sees that because that's the way the city is built. You look out and you see that stuff right there. And then you walk all the way up. So all the way at the right, so to say, edge, is the Beis HaMikdash. What's the difference between picture 7 and picture 8 as far as the Beis HaMikdash is concerned? One's got a big tall thing and the other one doesn't have a big tall thing, right? So here we have a little bit of an issue. And that is that if you pay attention to Malachim Aleph, Perek Vav, Pasuk Gimel, it seems that the area of the height is Shloshim Amah. But when you compare that exact same pasuk to Divrei Hayomim, Perek Gimel, Divrei Hayomim Beis, Perek Gimel, Pasuk Dalid, it speaks of Esrim Umeyo Amah, that the Ulam should be 120 Amah. The Ulam is the beginning, the front of this building. How large should it be? So if you follow Malachim Aleph, then it's picture number 7. If you follow Divrei Hayomim, it's picture number 8. Many Chachamim, Rishonim, Achronim try to figure out the discrepancy, and there's like 30 answers to this question, but at the end of the day, one says one amount, one says a different amount. So when you look at pictures of Bayis Rishon, you will immediately see which one they followed. Interestingly enough, the Gemara Chazal never discussed this discrepancy. It's only the later Rishonim and the Achronim who discuss it, but in the Gemara, it's not found. You'd expect the Gemara maybe to make a comment, or maybe they had no traditions about it, or maybe it was not something that... Now, in Bayis Sheni, that structure will be 100 Amah. But in Bayis Rishon, we don't know. Okay, so now follow me along for a second to number 4. Yeah. Okay, so now let's look at a more comprehensive idea of what bias Rishon look like, at least in locality. So if you look again on page number 4, notice on the upper right you'll see the temple and the royal palace. David HaMelech and Shlomo HaMelech had their palace up there. Next to the palace was the bias. And then following down came this famous, the Ophel area. And walking right into it, you came to the city of David, which of course has been dug up today, and people go visit there, and all these interesting things are there. What is quite astounding here is that if you remember, Yerushalayim had a constant source of water with this underground, wonderful Gihon spring that actually was dug from two ends in antiquity, and it supplied water into Yerushalayim all the time. And that was the secret of its survival, besides Hashem watching over it all the time. The enemy never knew, hoping to surround whoever it was that surrounded Yerushalayim and said, don't worry, eventually they'll die of hunger. If not of hunger, they'll die of thirst, especially during certain seasons when there is no rain. Little did they know that there was a constant fresh water coming into Yerushalayim all the time. And it was used in many different ways. Now, if you notice for a second on that picture, towards the middle, it says broad wall segment. Do you see that? Okay, so if you go for a second now to page 6, and if you've been in Yerushalayim in two places, you will find walls from Bayis Rishon. One is known as the Broad Wall, and part of it is today in Migdal David, and the walls are there. So next time you're in Yerushalayim, Mir HaKodesh, in the Old City, say to yourself, let me spend 5 minutes to actually see a wall that was built in the days of Shlomo, in the days of Bayis Rishon. That wall today has been, so I was telling you, it's going further by the discovery of archaeology than we thought it went. Much further, which is quite amazing. The Gihon Springs?
Yeah.
What is sad is that archaeologists about 7 years ago actually discovered the inscription that was made by the diggers in antiquity saying, this is where we met. It was two teams that went underground to connect all this to bring it into Yerushalayim. And where they met, they stopped digging, and we see through archaeology today how they missed a little bit and eventually did get together and opened it up. But they made a nice inscription. The inscription today is in?
Aramaic.
I'm sorry?
What
language
is it?
It is Aramaic. Okay, where is should it be?
Israel.
Israel. Guess what? It's not. It's in Istanbul, in a museum. So if you happen to be in Istanbul and you want to see something from this particular time period, go look at it there. Well, things in museums travel interestingly. It depends who discovers it, with the team of archaeologists, what country they come from, even though today there are laws of antiquities in each country, whatever is found in that particular era belongs to that country. When that was discovered, people just said, okay, wrap it up and send it. Sometimes also, by the way, museums exchange pieces and never return it. So, you know, what's known as the Mesha inscription, Mesha Melech Moav, mentioned in Malachim, speaks of his attacking Israel and his, so to say, he put up a nice little stone commemorating his victory over Eretz Israel, which belongs, by the way, to the Louvre. It's now, for the last easily 50 years, in the British Museum. The British Museum still keeps it on loan. And every year a letter is written, could you please return it? And they say yes. And of course, yes means yes, but not today, maybe tomorrow. Yes? Yes, there was, Nachman Avigad's daughter, yes, correct, sure. Part of it is in Ir David, meaning much of the archaeology in this area, when you discover things, you try to figure out what they are and what they belong to. So that has now narrowed part of the royal palace here and part of the royal palace here. That's archaeology wise, it's an amazing field. It really is, because it brings the past for us as Jews. There is no greater historical confirmation of many of our things except through archaeology. It is quite unbelievable. The amount of coins that have been found, the inscriptions that we know of. For example, we possess today the signet ring of Baruch ben Neriah, the student of Yirmiyahu HaNavi, going back to that time period. So some very important signet rings of the most important families have been discovered. Of course, unfortunately, a couple of charlatans in the past years have forged certain things for notoriety, money, and other things, but overall, archaeology is a pretty solid field. Someone's hand was up. Yes?
Do they have a replica of the inscription inside
the tunnel? Yes. Yes, they do. Yes, they have a replica, correct. And under the replica, it says the real thing is in Istanbul. Yes. Sure. Unfortunately, the impact of the local idol worship cults was also something at play here. That's why throughout the period of Bais Rishon, when there are Nevi'im and there are people who tell people what to do, and Dvar Hashem is around and the Shechina is around at the same time, though, unfortunately, what you have there are people who worship idols, the locals, whoever is in particular each time period, different Avodah Zarah, every high place has something else, and that was a larger issue than the Beis HaMikdash there. Well, let me just, because you're asking a very good question that requires a drop more of an answer. Shlomo builds the Beis HaMikdash. Okay, David, if you remember, wants to build it. Nosan Hanavi tells him in Perek Zayin of Shmuel, you're not building it. Your son will build it. Exactly why? Some will say because your hands are filled with bloodshed, which was taken both in a good way, meaning bloodshed, you've actually spilled blood for a good reason. If you build it, it will never be destroyed, and it has to be destroyed. And that has to do with the whole theological idea of if Bais Rishon would have been built up Midas HaDin, then we would never be forgiven. It's a whole intricate idea which we don't need to discuss now. Or no, because that was a bad thing. And to build a Beis HaMikdash, you need clean hands. And Shlomo will build it. It takes about 7 years for Shlomo to build this building. It is a magnificent edifice. People across the world come to see it. Nothing of that sort was built in the area. The Canaanites did have temples and quite impressive ones, but nothing like the Beis HaMikdash. So it gives the people a great sense of centrality. All the Shvatim know, the tribes know, this is the place we should be coming to. But if you remember, in a very short time period, and this is so sad, 36 years later, when Shlomo has died and Rehavam, his son, becomes the new king, the Jewish people, who were united together for quite a while, but at least with the Beis HaMikdash for 36 years, we split. We split into two kingdoms, Malchus Yisrael and Yehuda. And not since then have we come together again as a people. That is sad. And I think part of what we need to learn during the 3 weeks, the idea of Ahavas Yisrael, the idea of forgetting sometimes certain things and looking beyond the small things and realizing that for 36 years only, we are one people. and have not been one since, and we're still worrying about the tiny stuff, and then you wonder why the Beis HaMikdash isn't built. It's sad. When Yecheskel HaNavi has the nevuah of take Eitzim, take two sticks, and put them together, they should be one stick. One is Malchus Yisrael, one is Malchus Yehuda, and that will be the future. And that future hasn't happened yet. So there is concern more of the Avodah Zarah there, which is a cult. And then Yeravam, if you remember, who is the rival of Rechavam, builds his own temple. And we have two rival temples. So the Beis HaMikdash had a little bit of competition. And then, of course, in this wonderful time period, as I mentioned earlier, about 135 years before the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, the Aseres HaShvatim are taken away. And all that's left is the tribe of Yehuda and Binyamin and a couple of Levim. So they disappear. Then the Nebuchadnezzar enters the picture, and Nebuchadnezzar doesn't come once, he comes twice, and still doesn't destroy it. And Nebuzaradan comes a third time, and within that 11-year period of Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonians have come, and the Beis HaMikdash gets destroyed. So it was never the greatest of glorious periods, except for a short time period. The Nevi'im yelled at the people, stop the Avodah Zarah, stop the corruption, stop treating each other not nicely, stop the oppressed, give charity. From the Nevi'im, Yirmiyahu's at the end of the bias, is so upset about the fact that the Jews in Yerushalayim were not keeping Shabbos. And he has to tell them, you have to keep Shabbos, otherwise this house will be destroyed. And Yirmiyahu himself, and all the Nevi'im, by the way, that we speak of, except for a few who see both, or we'll speak of next week, see that Beis HaMikdash, the one. There are no Nevi'im in Tobias Sheni, just a tiny drop at the beginning. And then, of course, it's destroyed, and we go into what we call the Babylonian exile. And let me tell you, it was not easy. But when you enter the gates of cities like Nineveh or the city of Babylon, and you looked at the structures that Nebuchadnezzar built, which were huge and beautiful. And it was a good life. So when Ezra and Nehemiah and everyone else says, let's go back home because the 7 years have returned, Babel's the golden of Medina. It looks good over here. Who's going home? A drop over 40,000 return, when we estimate that there were easily close to over 1 million Jews already in Babel at that time. 40,000 return, 44,000, I think it was. And then we have Bayis Sheni. So I will stop here, unless you have a question. Yes? The society was basically... So most of Yerushalayim, so if you look for a second, either, again, on page 8 at the bottom, where, again, you have already a larger building of this area, I would say for most of the time of Bayis Rishon, you had about 1,000 families living in the area of Yerushalayim itself. The rest are spread through Hebron and wherever, and all the other cities. Yerushalayim had about 1,000 families in it. Part of it were members and relatives of the royal family, whoever was in power, and it was not that nice sometimes, whoever ruled, again. And then, of course, at some point, there's Avodah Zarah here.
So was it the rich and famous?
It was the rich and famous and the poor. Absolutely, they were poor people. They were also slaves who should have been given their freedom, like Yirmiyahu tells us, and yells at them, free your slaves. And they didn't free their slaves when they had to.
How many of them were observant in terms of the religious halakhic obligations at the time, following the Kohanic principles?
I would assume that most were, and enough were not that the Navi in every single generation had to remind them that there's Hashem.
And
And if you remember the descriptions, they were pretty intense. It's the idea of being married to Hashem, if you remember, with the Navi Hosea, where Hosea marries a prostitute in his prophecy or in reality, depending on how you understand it, which is possible both ways. Rashi says it was literal. Other Chachamim say it was just in a Mare Nevuah, in a vision. And then people ask him, what are you doing? Or in the prophetic vision, he says, this is what I saw. And why did you see that? Because you people, says Hashem, you have left me. I've taken you out of Egypt. I've given you a piece of land that's flourishing and everything. And what have you done? I've given you commandments to keep. Are you keeping them? So yes, you had a serious amount of the population who was not observant in a true Torah way. How about Azara? Pretty serious.
And the last question I have is, what differences halachically with people living within the walls have to people living outside the walls? Like, how does it affect their everyday life?
It's interesting that those laws they were very careful about.
Everyone
outside the walls. Yeah. Isn't that funny?
That is funny.
But that's, you know, they'll do Avodah Zarah, but Dinim of Tumah Tahara they'll keep. Okay, for sure. And we know that because in the homes where we find statue of Avodah Zarah, usually it was the Avodah Zarah of Baal, we see their utensils were made in such ways that basically, for example, stone can never become Tameh. So they made tables out of stone, chairs out of stone, plates out of stone, yet they had an Avodah Zarah in the house. Anyway, maybe in schus of this bias, Shlishi will be built tonight, so I don't see you next week. But if not, have a good week. And
Sure. The toughness of the bias region.
Right.
We have accurate.
No. No, we have. It's not clear for Novi. So let me give you an idea for a second.
Two more books for your son.
Oh my goodness. Okay, thank you so much. I mean, I'll show them next week, but here is one understanding of it.
This is the Yom Shoshana.
This is the Yom Shoshana.